America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is The Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, where the greatest political success story in the whole history of this great nation has been the Constitution of the United States. Today is Constitution Day. There has been nothing like it in the history of human beings. People coming together, putting together a charter for liberty and a charter for operating a government, and that charter having come forward with relatively minor changes, 27 of them, over all of these years. It's a miracle. And I know that Akhil Reed Amar thinks so. He's written about it. His most recent book, which I think is the best of all his outstanding books, is called The Words That Made Us, America's Constitutional Conversation, 1760 to 1840, which is a fascinating book, not just about the framing of the Constitution and the origins of it, but the way that it came to be understood in a very disputatious fashion in the first years of the Republic. Akhil Reed Amar is a Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale, and he teaches constitutional law at both Yale College to undergraduates and at Yale Law School, and his work has been cited by Supreme Court justices across the spectrum, from what are considered to be the more liberal justices to the most conservative justices in over 40 cases. Akhil, it's great to speak to you again.
And likewise, and especially on such a special day, it means a lot to that you asked me to be here on this special day for all of us.
Thank you. I wanted to play for you. There was a campus reform organization sent a reporter out just to campus speaking to normal students at the University of Florida. And I wanted to give you a chance to respond to some of what they said to the question about whether the Constitution is outdated. This is clip 11A.
So Constitution Day is on September 17th. What do you guys think of the Constitution?
Absolutely terrible. Needs to be redone immediately.
I think it needs a lot more reform for the changes that have happened since then.
I think a lot of the things in there, they do need to be like reevaluated, I guess.
I think we just need to update it on like more equality, equity, stuff like that.
Okay, so the Constitution, I feel like it's outdated, like some of the stuff on there.
I think that our Constitution that we have for America is to some degree outdated, but I also think it is very historical.
Do you think the Constitution is outdated?
I mean, I think it has to be. It was written in the late 1700s. It wasn't written for the 21st century.
Extremely. It's completely outdated. It was written by those that don't represent the both of us at the moment, and it didn't represent everybody at the time.
Yes.
Yes, a tad.
There are a lot of outdated things in there that nowadays aren't accepted.
So what do you think, Akhil? How do you respond to folks like that who think there are a lot of things in there that are outdated? Your response?
I would say, with great respect, read the book. You don't have to buy it. Read it. And you can then decide for yourself what it really says and what it really doesn't say. The book doesn't actually carry the story forward for all of American history. The amendments are really important, and not all of them came from the founding era. The most important, of course, are the Reconstruction Amendments, ending slavery and promising equality for all Americans born in the United States, full and equal citizenship, political rights for blacks. Later in the saga, a doubling of the franchise with woman suffrage. In our lifetime, Michael, changes, for example, that eliminated poll tax disfranchisement. So before we change it, and maybe it deserves some changes, previous generations of Americans have made amends, but they've done so knowing the document that they sought to change. So read it. The document itself, it's short. Read the historical materials about the context that generated the text, And then you'll be in a much better position to decide just how outdated it is. And one final thing, you have to judge it in its historical context. So for you, what you need to know is that more people were invited to participate in the process by which they and their posterity would be governed in a year that began on September 17, 1787. More people were invited to participate in that we, the people, do ordain and establish this constitutional process than had ever been allowed to vote on anything before in human history. So we can look back and see the exclusions, or we can understand it in context and say, wow, it begins a process that continues to this day of adding to liberty and equality. It's not perfect, but it's more perfect than what came before. And we can make it more perfect still, but we need to understand it in its historical context. And that story actually began on September 17th when these impressive folks who met behind closed doors put their plan before the people, for the people to say yes or no. In 8 of the 13 states, ordinary property qualifications for voting were abolished or lowered. In New York, every adult free male got to vote on the Constitution. No race tests, no religious tests, no literacy tests, no property qualifications. Now, there were exclusions from today's perspective. What about women? But compared to 1786 or 1686 or 1586, wow, what an extraordinary event in historical context.
A step forward for all of humankind. At your book, by the way, again, we've posted it on the website at michaelmedved.com, The Words That Made Us, America's Constitutional Conversation, 1760 to 1840. Let me ask you about something else, and I'm sure you have seen this, and it involves two of your colleagues. I'll name them. Professor Aziz Rana at Cornell, and there is Professor Franita
Tolson,
exactly, at USC. And they both contributed to a piece in the New York Times under the heading, Will We Ever Amend the Constitution Again? And they thought not, because it is so difficult to get through a constitutional amendment. And, of course, our founders made that deliberate. And what's amazing is Professor Tolson suggested outright that the only way to change the Constitution at this point is violence. And she says, we don't have to, we can get there without 700,000 people dying, as they did in the Civil War, but there will not be a way to get there without violence. The violence, she said, is already happening. January 6th was a manifestation of the political dispute in our country right now, much like the country in 1859. The question is, how many people have to die before we decide who America will be in the next generation and next century? Do you buy that the only means for constitutional change is violence?
Not at all. I speak to you today from Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, at the University of Illinois. My brother's dean of the law school here. I'm wearing my Lincoln tie. I just gave a lecture to everyone on Lincoln, so let me just remind folks of a few things. I used to think that the Constitution, is too hard to amend. So many good ideas that are being blocked. But now I don't quite think so anymore. Here's why. The Constitution was hard to adopt. And what's hard to adopt maybe should be hard to change, but not impossible. The very people who adopted the Constitution immediately added 10 amendments. We call those the Bill of Rights. So if it were impossible to amend, how is it that within 2 years you get 10 amendments, and those amendments came from people who were respectful critics? They say, yeah, it's a good idea, but it could be better. Oh, and they were listened to. And people who voted on opposite sides of the Constitution came together to support a Bill of Rights. Wow. And then Lincoln comes along and says, you know, let's stick, we can make it better still, but we can't do it through violence. We do it through elections. And the Constitution, and people didn't listen to him. We had a Civil War, but in the aftermath of that, we did have transformative amendments.
Okay, Akhil, can you hang on for a few more moments? Because
yeah,
on Constitution Day, this deserves even more time with... Michael Medved Show. A real pleasure to welcome back my friend, Akhil Reed Amar, on Constitution Day. He's the author, most recently, of an absolutely marvelous and very readable book. It's not even one scrap academic. It reads like an adventure story and a novel, and with all the personalities in vivid and full color. The book is called The Words That Made Us, America's Constitutional Conversation, 1760, you'll notice before the Revolution, to 1840. Akhil, when people look at what's out of order with the Constitution right now, as a lot of people believe, they often focus on the Electoral College and the tremendous disaster we had concerning the certification of the votes on January 6th last year. Tomorrow there's going to be another demonstration in behalf of the demonstrators who were arrested and charged. It's called Justice for J6. And it is not expected to have a huge outcome, but there will be thousands of people there. What do you say to people who suggest that we need a profound constitutional change in the way we elect our president? Do you think that's true? Do you think it's likely to happen?
It's not crazy to think that the best way to pick a president would be one person, one vote, and here's why it's not. It's how every American state picks its governor. And a governor is a little mini president in a way. In 48 of the states, they have four-year terms, not New Hampshire and Vermont. They've got veto pens. They got pardon pens. And in every state, Texas, California, Washington State, Illinois, Connecticut, we count every vote equally. And if it's close, we recount them carefully. So that's not preposterous. And it's a deeply American idea. So now we're remembering on Constitutional Day, there's not just the federal constitution to remember, but 50 state constitutions to also celebrate. And many of the ideas that states explored first, the federal constitution eventually came to copy, like a Bill of Rights, woman suffrage, black suffrage, and end to slavery. So it's not a preposterous idea that that would be a better way to do it. That said, there would be going to be some complications if you try to move to a direct election system. And there is an argument for sticking with what we've got, just because although it's not perfect, it's the devil we know. But here's the biggest point. No matter which system we have, once the rules are in place before the election, you have to abide by the rules, win, lose, or draw. You don't try to undo an election by force of arms, which is what happened when Abraham Lincoln was elected fair and square. Under an electoral college. So here's why this year that we're celebrating today, that begins on September 17th, 1787, is so impressive. A lot of people were for the Constitution in the year of elections that happened after that. A lot of people were against the Constitution. It was very closely fought. In New York, in the special convention that voted for the Constitution, it actually passed by a single vote. But the losers of that vote acquiesced. They said, okay, it was fair and square. People played by the rules. We lost. We'll accept the verdict. We think there should be changes and amendments. And the winner says, actually, we listen to you. We work together. Everyone, whether they were for or against the Constitution, agreed that George Washington would be a great leader. He was unanimously elected President of the United States, and he said in his inaugural address, let's have a Bill of Rights, because actually the people who lost thought that would be a good idea, and we admit that there can be improvements. We can make amendments. We've made it hard to amend, but not impossible. And actually, the amendments began in the very process of adopting the Constitution itself. And that can be a good lesson for us. If we study history, people who fiercely opposed each other came together to elect George Washington and adopt a Bill of Rights. Wow.
And on this question of the Electoral College and how it works, there's also been a lot of talk that we could actually improve the functioning of that institution by amending the Electoral Count Act of 1887, which is much easier to do than amending the Constitution. Amending the Constitution is tough, isn't it? Because there would be, all you need is 1/4 of the states to oppose a constitutional amendment, a fourth of state legislatures, and it's not going to pass. And there are enough small states that cherish the Electoral College, right?
Yes. Now, whether the small states really are an advantage is a nice question. We've only had four small state presidents in all of American history: Zachary Taylor, Franklin Pierce, Bill Clinton, and Joe Biden. So it's actually not so clear that it advantages small states as opposed to big swing states. The Floridas of the world, Pennsylvanias and Michigans, big states that are also close states, swing states. So it's not so clear, but you're absolutely right. You need 38 states to say yes, three quarters. Any 13 could say no. So I don't think we're likely to see a constitutional amendment. The Electoral Count Act is a mere statute. It does have some glitches in it. People have proposed reforms of those glitches, but the most important thing, forget all the technical glitches, we as a country, as citizens, have to come together and respect each other and respect actually the rules of the game. Even when our side loses this election, we have to say, okay, but there's going to be one after that, and one after that, and one after that, and that's what we need to actually understand, that if my side loses, we accept the results. If someone else's side, if your side loses, you know, you accept the results. That's how we have to go forward as a country.
Okay, we have just a few moments left to us, Akhil Reed Amar. What's the biggest mistake people make about the Constitution, or what they don't realize about it, misunderstand about it, and how do you correct it?
The two biggest mistakes are that it's only 1787 as opposed to a whole series of amendments, many of which were transformative, like woman suffrage, like in our own lifetime, yours and mine, civil rights amendments that ended poll tax disenfranchisement. It's not one old thing. It's an intergenerational project. So that's, you know, the one of the two biggest mistakes I think people make about the Constitution. And the second that they make is thinking that we should that we can kind of ignore our history rather than study it, because it's what makes us us. It's what makes America America. We're not unified by religion or race or ethnicity or politics, but we all have the Constitution in common and the constitutional story behind it: the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, George Washington, Abraham Lincoln. And that story is a story that all Americans can claim, even if they then, once they know that story, they can figure out how our generation could improve that story.
Which is one of the reasons for the importance of recognizing Constitution Day, which has only fairly recently become a true holiday. But it's important to look at the Constitution to understand it. And by the way, to check out Akhil Reed Amar's books, which are widely available and you will find hugely entertaining. Akhil, happy Constitution Day to you, and I can imagine you wearing your Abraham Lincoln tie. It's always a good day to wear an Abraham Lincoln tie, not just on Lincoln's birthday, but on Constitution Day as well. We will be right back with some of the taxation aspects of Constitution. What about that slogan, tax the rich? We'll talk about that with Grover Norquist coming up on the... It's always a problem when a political platform can be simplified into a three-word slogan. Well, that is the case right now with Joe Biden's tax plan, where it can be reduced to three words: tax the rich. Well, actually, you got to add on, because there's not just the rich who are going to be socked by that tax plan. That, however, fits onto the Met Gala dress of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Here, someone who is almost as much an avatar of fashion, Grover Norquist from Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, the president has been just unbelievable on this issue. He said recently, and I want to give you a chance to respond to him, because you can do that better than anybody. The president had this to say about his new tax plan. This is clip four.
My Republican friends are making a different choice, though. They'd rather protect the tax breaks of those at the very top.
to give tax breaks to working families. It's that simple. But let me ask you this. Where is it written that all the tax breaks in the American tax code go to corporations and the very top? I think it's enough. I'm tired of it. For me, it's pretty simple. It's about time working people got the tax breaks in this country. That's what my plan does. And here's what it also does. By asking big corporations and the very wealthy to pay their fair share, it makes it possible to invest in America.
Okay, Grover, what's the best way to respond to that?
Wow. but it's all nonsense. I mean, you guys sort of deconstruct it. One lie, and it's a big one, and it is that we're going to tax corporations, not people. Okay? Well, even the Joint Tax Committee, which is a more liberal part of the Congress, said that when you tax corporations, at least a quarter of that tax is paid directly by workers in lower wages. Now, you know, that's $2 trillion in corporate taxes. That's $500 billion in lower wages paid by working people. That is the tax he is putting on working people, and he knows it, or his advisors know it. Liberals admit that it's a quarter. The other economists that are more free market and take into effect dynamic scoring say it's about 75%. So it's at $1.5 trillion in lower wages to get $2 trillion in corporate taxes. The corporate tax, corporations don't pay taxes. They collect money from customers, and they give money to the government. So to the extent they can, they may raise prices. That's true. They could raise prices on consumers, all consumers. The point of the corporate tax is to hide that people are paying it, and the people who are paying it are not particularly rich. And Biden knows better, and so he's up there just making stuff up in that case. He talks about tax breaks for lower-income people. What he means is welfare checks he's sending to people. Checks. He's going to have the IRS send you a check. That's not a tax cut. That's welfare spend. It's getting money, not for doing something in particular, but for being lower income. Here's your money. Here's money. That's a welfare program. It is not a tax cut. So he's trying to do the claim that his welfare spending are actually tax cuts because he'll have the IRS write you the check.
Okay, this whole thing, including the famous dress with tax the rich on it with AOC, all of it is based on one basic assumption, which is a core to the entire Democratic worldview, which is that the rich don't pay their fair share. What's the best way to respond to that?
Well, the top few percent pay more than half of all the taxes in the country on the income taxes. It is wildly progressive, which is why every time we cut income taxes across the board, Democrats say, that's mostly going to rich people. Yes, because if you cut taxes 25% across the board as Reagan did, or 25% across the board as FDR did, you know what? The guy at the top who's paying a much higher percentage of his income than a lower income person who's paying nothing, but it's bottom half of taxpayers don't pay the federal income tax. We have a very progressive, graduated, confiscatory tax system now, so that if you equally cut everybody's taxes, the person who's earning more gets a much bigger tax because they're paying a much larger part of the total bill. And that's been true for a long time after Reagan's tax cuts. But one of the things is as you cut taxes and have more economic growth, people recognize more income, pay more taxes. Higher income people paid more taxes at the end of the Reagan administration, not less as a percentage of the whole budget. So they sit there and go, you're just helping rich people, and yet they're taking more and more of the total tax burden as a result of lower taxes for everybody.
How do you possibly help, quote, corporations and help the wealthy without simultaneously helping people who get paid by those corporations and by the wealthy?
You don't. Companies spend 80-90% of the money they get paying people. And if you take money away from companies, the one way they can spend less money is to pay their workers less, to have fewer workers or pay them less, give them fewer, more rare raises. That is exactly what the corporate income tax does. It's just a way to hide who's paying it. The Democrats know that at the end of the day, you know, middle-income people pay a lot of taxes. They said they weren't going to have any direct taxes on lower-income people. President just the other, or the Senate House Democrats came up and said $100 billion on taxes on cigarette smokers, average income $40,000 a year, and even higher taxes on vapors for people who are thinking of stopping smoking and vaping instead. They don't want you leaving smoking because then you don't pay your cigarette taxes anymore. So they don't care about your health. They care about tax dollars, and the fact that they're hitting lower income people is beyond the point. They want the cash. They want the cash. They want the cash.
What about the constant attempt to impose a death tax or to raise a death tax in this country? Are they going to succeed with that this time, with the inheritance tax taking away people that money have earned their whole lives, saved, and want to pass on to their kids?
They want to have a second death tax. There's the one where they come and they take, you know, 40% of what you saved all your life. Your estate is your life savings. They tend not to call it your life savings. They say estate, so it sounds like some British duke or something. But your life savings, they want to take, you know, about half of it when you die. But beyond that, what Biden has argued for is removing a part of the tax code, a protection for family farms that was put in 100 years ago. 100 years ago, family farms were ripped to half because in half, every generation, mom and dad would work, work, work. Inflation would happen. The value of your land would get to be, you know, maybe $100,000, $200,000 for the value of your farmland. And then the kids inherit it. And the government comes in and says, we need 20, 30, or 40% of the growth of the value of that. You know, they've gone from nothing, by the way, to $100,000. Well, we don't have any cash. All our wealth is in the land. Well, then you better sell some of your farm, don't you? And it was destroying family farms. Congress said, don't do this. So when mom and dad die, the children inherit the farm or the family business or life savings at the value at which it was when mom and dad died, so they don't pay capital gains or on the inflation of their parents' lifetime. And this saved a lot of family farms, a lot of small businesses. Biden wants to take that away. He wants you to pay two death tax. Mom and dad die. Imagine, guess what the value of the small business that they have is. You know, it's not publicly traded. It doesn't buy and sell. You got to guess what it's worth and pay through the nose there. Then when you inherit the money, they take a bunch of it a second time. We may be on the verge of stopping that second death tax that Biden wanted.
Well, this is crucial, and why people need to click on the banner for Grover Norquist and Americans for Tax Reform. Keep up the fight, my friend, and have a great weekend. We'll be right back with the movies for this weekend coming up on the MedVet Show.
32.
Coming into this weekend, there's actually one wish that I think ought to unite everybody in this country who has a patriotic bone in your body, which is the wish that the big demonstration that everyone is talking about and overhyping ends up peaceful, constructive, not divisive, not violent, and not attacking cops by any side or either side. Wouldn't that be a good thing to wish for the Justice for J6 demonstration that is being planned? It seems to me totally needlessly, but okay, it's planned. It's happening tomorrow. We will give you the very latest on all of that on Monday. Okay, films for this weekend from Hollywood. I would imagine that the film that will have the biggest public appeal is a movie called Cop Shop, and it stars Gerard Butler in what I think could rightly be described as just about the best performance of his career. Here's the basic setup. There's a police station, police outpost, really, in the Nevada desert, not far from Las Vegas. And there are two individuals who both attack cops, and they end up attacking the cops to try to get into jail. Why? Well, because they're both dangerous customers and both looking for basically police protection. Real star of the film is a rookie cop who is played by a totally outstanding new actress who first leading role. Her name is Alexis Lauder. She's black. She's extraordinarily charismatic, and she carries this movie. Listen.
What'd you do?
I did what I had to do to get to you, Teddy.
You're a psychopath.
I'm a professional.
Drop that gun. No one kills anyone in here.
How bad is it?
Are you an idiot, Teddy?
Anthony Lamb.
What are we gonna do to the death?
Here they come.
Let's make a deal, man. I got a lot of money.
There's no deal to be made.
Come on, Teddy.
You know how this goes.
Okay, no, you don't know how this goes, and it's unpredictable. The performances are consistently fine. Basically the standout performance by the newcomer, Alexis Lauder. But the thing about the film is that the characterizations are so interesting. Now, it's extraordinarily brutal, and some of the brutality is laid on to such an extent that no one could survive all of that the way that the characters on film do. But the Buchanan, who's the director, is one of those people who is an expert at action sequences, and these are very well made. Is this an uplifting film? No, not particularly, but is it riveting and well-paced and skillfully made? It is. 2.5 stars for the very much R-rated. There's a great deal of blood and, yes, guts in this particular movie. 2.5 stars for Cop Shop. The other big movie that is being released this weekend is actually a film that's based on a BBC documentary. And I know that doesn't sound tremendously appetizing. Well, the documentary is a film that basically was called Jamie, Drag Queen at 16. And it's about a student in high school in Britain, in Sheffield, England, who wants to... He's asked in class, and he has had this lifelong dream of wanting to be a drag queen. And the film is called Everybody's Talking About Jamie. Listen.
What do you want to be?
A performer.
For a minute there, I had such hair. I had high hopes for you.
Why do you want to be on stage?
I want to be a drag queen because it's all I ever dream of. And when I close my eyes, it's all I can see.
You are a freak.
They made me feel so ugly. I'm scared.
Your banana dress is something to be laughed at.
Stop waiting for permission to be you.
Okay, the film has some snappy musical numbers. It's rated as a musical, comedy, biographical, bittersweet film. And Max Harwood, who plays Jamie, though he doesn't look 16 years old, he looks older, is clearly very talented at singing and dancing. And the musical numbers don't have such catchy music, but they have very clever lyrics. And it sort of puts along. But it's utterly predictable in terms of the interactions of the characters, and yes, it's based on a true life story, but honestly, the basic point is made so many different times about how Jamie needs sympathy and support that it seems almost like a public service ad rather than a film with great entertainment value. Everybody's Talking About Jamie is a PG-13 rated. There is no graphic sexuality, but for a film that is all about the misunderstandings, particularly between a father who's divorced from the mother and rejects the boy, Jamie, who's the center of the film. Yes, of course, there's some harsh language for the PG-13 rating. 2 stars for Everybody's Talking About Jamie, which will probably get much more praise than it deserves as a work of cinema, because it also serves as a work of propaganda. Then we have another film with one of the greatest stars in the world, Oscar winner Michael Caine. He plays a curmudgeonly has-been author who is coming back 50 years after having written his last successful novel. And he's being brought back by his book editor, or would-be book editor, the head of his publishing company she inherited from her dad, played by Aubrey Plaza. The book is called Best Sellers. Listen.
I won't do the bloody tour. Bloody.
Do the tour, or I edit the book. Those are your choices.
No one's interested in the book. They're interested in this freak show.
This man is the book reviewer for the Times.
I don't like book critics.
It is not selling, okay? No one is buying it. I can't get him to do anything. All I am to him is his driver and his Scotch Sherpa. Let's go. Do you want to buy a book?
You want to know what I think? Times have changed.
Okay, times have changed, but times have never been like they are portrayed here. I've been in the book business my whole life. I mean, and this represents no book business you've ever seen. It's a silly fantasy. The characters are extremely thin, ranging on caricature. Basic exposition is laid out as clumsily as it possibly could be. And the entire premise of the book is that when she finally gets him to go out and do book tour, he gets a lot of attention because he uses the BS word and the British version of the BS word and shouts it out. And everybody then becomes so captivated by that that the book becomes a surprise success. Now, that's not really a spoiler alert, because there's much more and there's some secrets and twists. None of it works. And what's really striking to me is this entire story is based upon writing. And it's based upon a writer's life and learning how to write and writing beautifully and editing beautifully. And the writing's horrible in the film. The performances, as you might expect from Aubrey Plaza, who can be very funny and very endearing, and Michael Caine, who, after all, is Michael Caine, who is a wonderful screen presence. Despite that, they are trapped by the extraordinarily sloppy writing. It isn't rated, but it would be rated probably R because of the language, which is supposed to be such a big part of the film, as if we would be shocked today by harsh language from a public author. 1.5 stars for Best Sellers. I think it's fascinating to make books, plays, stories about writers. Why not? But at least they ought to be well written. The better of the movies of the three that we covered this week, that I saw this week, Cop Shop, which may not be a work of literature, but it's a thriller with characters who make an indelible impression. Coming up on Monday, speaking of characters who make an indelible impression, Chris Christie is that kind of character, and Governor Christie is going to be on talking about the right political way to handle this whole issue of mandates for masks, for vaccines, and more. He has a different approach than what you have heard from either extreme. There's also a new bill in Florida where they're considering legislation that would restrict state scholarship money for programs, majors, that aren't in demand in the workforce. Good idea? It could be. It could, in fact, be a crucial and very influential idea for this greatest nation on God's